Welcome to Solder Smoke, a podcast about homebrew electronics and amateur radio. This is a program for people who like to melt solder and build their own rigs. For other episodes of the program, go to www.soldersmoke.com. For the latest Solder Smoke news, go to soldersmoke.blogspot.com. Please send feedback to n2cqr@yahoo.com. So, as we step away from our soldering irons and oscilloscopes, please join us for another edition of Solder Smoke. All right, good morning. It's Sunday, the 21st of December, 2008. This is Solder Smoke 97. First of all, before I forget, Merry Christmas to everybody. Happy holidays. I hope everybody's having a good one. I hope the shopping craziness is not getting to you. Hang in there. And I hope everybody has a wonderful Christmas. Hey, let's start out with some Italy travelogue. We've had some interesting climatic developments here in Italy, especially in the Rome area. Well, up north, they're getting a lot of snow, unusual amounts of snow this year. We are planning on taking the kids out to see some of it. You could see, as I mentioned last episode, you could see the snow-capped peaks from Rome. And we're going to just drive out to them. You only have to drive about an hour and a half, and you're in snow up on the in the central mountains of Italy, the Apennines right there. So we're just going to take a day trip sometime this week, take the kids out, let them play in the snow. Yeah, so, but there's been some really bad weather here, too. It's we've got an unusual amount of rain here in Rome in December. Thunder and lightning storms, I mean, you heard some of them. We heard one of them last year when we were recording in the middle of a thunderstorm. But we've had some real thunder boomers here in December. Very unusual. And like I said, lots and lots of rain. The Tiber River, the Tevere, was close to, I guess it flooded in some areas. It didn't really go over its banks in most of Rome. But, man, I'm telling you, it was fast and high. We live right near the Isola Tiberina, which is the island in the Tiber River. There's a hospital and a church and a couple little stores out there. It's a very, very historically significant place, and it didn't get flooded, but the waters were coming up close to flood stage there. And actually, for a few days here, one of the big attractions in Rome was to go down and take a look at the Tiber and see just how much water was going past there. It was kind of interesting. Hey, I wanted to give you a couple words, just a part of the travelogue thing here. People write in and say that they enjoy the Italy travelogue. A couple of words. Do you know how to say the at sign? You in an email address, you have the at sign. How do you say that in Italian? And this is, for me, a kind of a good example of the kind of evocative, picturesque way in which Italian often deals with these kinds of things. The word they use is chiocciola, chiocciola. And what chiocciola means, if you look it up in the dictionary, it means snail. It looks like a little snail. So actually in Italy, when you're giving somebody your email address, you say, you're literally saying, yeah, send me an email at n2cqrsnail@yahoo.com. I thought that was pretty neat. And also in a ham radio conversation, you know, when there's a breaker, we always say, oh, somebody's breaking in, or somebody says there's a breaker. I guess that's kind of CB talk, but it's sort of seeped into the ham radio culture. But in Italy, they say that somebody, abusato, the word they use is bussare, which is knocking. Somebody's knocking on the door. Little things like that, I think, kind of interesting. All right, let's get down to the real business here. DSB, double sideband news. You guys have been hearing about my work on yet another double sideband rig. this is part of my rig, what I call my rig reform process. I'm taking rigs that I built in other places, mostly from the Azores, London, some going as far back as Washington. We were in Washington from 96 to 2000. And I like all these rigs, but I like to think that I've made some progress in terms of technical understanding and building skills since I first put some of these devices together. And now what I'm trying to do is go back and apply some of the lessons learned to these older rigs in an effort to kind of reform them. I mean, sometimes it's pretty much like ham radio archaeology, because I first have to go back and figure out what I did, sort of ham radio forensics. I got to go in there and take a look at, you know, what the heck I did in this circuit and draw myself, perhaps for the first time, an actual schematic diagram of the of the rig in question, and then take a look at it and see how I might do things properly, you know, how I might actually match impedances, how I might actually decouple amplifier stages, how I might use, you know, feedback techniques to get enhanced stability, how I might actually measure the amount of power coming out of each amplifier stage, and think about things like gain distribution. You know, all these fine points that when you're in your early days as a home brewer, you just don't want to mess with this stuff. You're a man of action. You want to move ahead. You want to get on the air and proudly tell people, rig here is home brew, even if it sounds quite horrible. Well, anyway, like I said, I've moved on, and now I'm trying to apply the lessons learned from SSDRA and EMRFD and the QRPL and emails from Wes and others. And anyway, this is the rig reform process. I first reformed the 20-meter double sideband rig, and now I've taken the rig that I built in London, the kick panel rig, which is just a double sideband rig. Started out for 40 meters, and I've rebuilt it for 80. Double sideband. One nice thing about this rig reform process, it saves you some of the parts of homebrewing that I'm not really all that crazy about. The cabinet making, you know, the box building, the woodwork, the side panels, the connectors on the back, all that stuff. Not really my favorite part of the project, but necessary, of course. Unless you want the rig spread out on the table and just circuit boards and clip leads. We've all been there. Rig reform has proceeded. The cabinet work already having been done. I'm really coming to the conclusion that in a lot of ways, double sideband is actually a bit harder than single sideband. Of course, you have additional circuitry with single sideband rig, but that crystal filter in there, that cleans up and really compensates for a lot of ugliness and sins that might exist in the signal coming out of the balanced modulator. But when you're running a DSB rig, there's really nothing there to clean up whatever junk might be coming out of your balanced modulator. So I think you have to be more careful that you're getting a clean signal out of the balanced modulator before sending it on to the amplifiers. And that's been a bit of the struggle that I've been involved in the last few weeks. I'm using very, very standard circuitry here. You could take a look at it. I have it up on the blog spot. On the blog page, I have the SPICE models up there. You'll see it's just a two-diode balanced modulator with a trifiller toroid matching transformer and a little 100-ohm pot for balance. But what I'm doing is I'm feeding a signal from an audio signal generator into the mic amp, and then just taking a look at the two-tone pattern that comes out of the balanced modulator. You know, with an SSB rig, you really do have to feed in two tones to get that kind of sideways hourglass pattern that you're looking for. Double sideband rig, because it's putting out, of course, two signals out of that balanced modulator, you only need one audio tone to generate the hourglass pattern, and you could use that to check for, you know, of course, for linearity and flap topping and all that. But anyway, I found that it was pretty difficult for me to get a nice looking, clean, sideways hourglass pattern out of the balanced modulator. And when I started, you know, consulting the literature and looking back and trying to find words of wisdom from the masters, and I found quite a few. Of course, SSDRA and EMRFD were very helpful. But I also found some information, some inspiration and information in the articles about the BitX20 by Farhan. And he pointed out the real need to provide a proper termination, a 50-ohm termination for all the frequencies coming out of the balanced modulator. If you don't do that, these frequencies have a tendency, to put it in very crude terms, just to kind of hang out there and stay there in the balanced modulator and generate all kinds of ugly signals. These diode balanced modulators are switching devices. Basically, the diodes are just switching on and off, and that can generate lots of harmonics and spurs and all kinds of ugly signals that will eventually show up on your scope as a decidedly not pretty, not very hourglass-like test pattern. There were recommendations. I mean, I think some people recommended pretty complicated diplexer terminations for the balanced modulator. Farhan has I think it's a 3 dB or a 6 dB resistive pad between the balanced modulator and the amplifiers. I was about to build one of those, but I just did some experimentation, and I found that if I put a 50-ohm resistor just across the output of the balanced modulator. I do have a little bit of a low pass. I have a three-element low-pass filter, and then I put a 50-ohm resistor across there. That 50-ohm resistor seems to make a lot of difference, and without it, the pattern is really ugly. With it, the pattern is beautiful. So I've achieved the elusive, clean, balanced two-tone pattern. There's quite a bit of carrier suppression. It looks really good, and so thanks to everybody who provided either direct advice or advice through the wonderful articles and books they've written over the years. A question popped up as I was working on this, and it just happened to be discussed on QRPL at around the same time, and that is, how important is it to actually match the diodes that you're using in these balanced mixer circuits, either one diode or two diodes or four diodes? You know, Doug DeMaw's books advise going in there and trying to match the forward and I guess reverse resistances of the diodes that you're going to use in these circuitries, because you are looking in the balanced circuits for symmetry. I always kind of wondered about this, because in almost all these circuits, right after the diodes, you have a 100-ohm pot, and it always seemed to me that if there were any kind of imbalances in there, that you would take care of that by the adjustment of the pot, and therefore the matching of the diodes in that kind of circuit seems to me to be not very important. There was a message in there in the QRPL from Allison, always a good source of information on this stuff, and it seemed to me that she was saying that that's correct, that if you don't have the pot in there, then it would be important to balance the diodes. But with the pot there, it becomes less important. Forgive me, Allison, if I'm if I've got your explanation wrong, but I think that's what the conclusion was. The rig, the 80 meter double sideband rig is done, and it is making QSOs. I've had some fun with it. I've worked stations all over Italy, and it is a little bit rough on 80 meters in Italy with 3.5 watts of double sideband to a less than optimal antenna, but it does make QSOs, and I plan on using it mostly for local contacts here. I've put in a couple of little kind of fun refinements in there that I just had had a good time with. One of the things, I don't have a receiver. This is just a transmitter. I'm using the Drake 2B as the receiver, and I guess I've done a fairly good job in shielding, especially the VFO circuit, as you're supposed to do in a double sideband rig or in a direct conversion receiver. But the problem is now that when I try to spot, when I try to net, as in the UK they call this netting, I guess in the States we call it spotting, I have a switch on the front of the transmitter that when I throw it, the only thing it does is it turns the oscillator on. And it does not, when you throw this particular switch, the receiver is not muted, and the amplifier stages are not turned on, and the antenna, it remains connected to the receiver. In other words, it's not the actual transmit-receive switch. It's just a spot switch that allows you to put your transmitter on whatever frequency you're receiving at the time to align the frequencies of the transmitter and receiver. The problem is that I did such a good job in shielding the VFO that I couldn't hear my own oscillator when I hit the spot switch. I needed a little bit of an antenna, just just 12 inches or so of wire running from the output of the oscillator stage out the back of the transmitter, just enough to put enough RF in the air around the shack to be picked up a few feet away by the Drake 2B. Now, after having done all this shielding, the thought of just sort of unshielding things for the purposes of spotting seemed kind of counterproductive. So I needed to work up a way to so that this little antenna would be connected when in the spot mode, but wouldn't be connected to the circuit when in the actual transmit mode, because I didn't want to, you know, be introducing all kinds of feedback loops and all kinds of, it would be a mess. Anyway, I worked it up with a little relay, and it was actually quite satisfying. So it was just in one of those other little mods that you could do. I just put a little tiny relay there that is activated only when the spot switch is on, and so when the spot switch goes on, essentially two things happen. The oscillator goes on, and this little antenna is connected to its output, so I'm able to spot my signal. But when the TR switch goes to T, that little antenna is disconnected from the circuit and is not there electrically. So that's been fun. Also, I had an extra hole in the front panel of this thing. That the front panel, the whole panel and side panels was made from the kick panel that I bought on Fulham Road in London. And in the original version of this thing, I needed I think 5 holes on the front. But now I only need 4, so there's this one extra hole there. So I said to myself, what am I going to do with this thing? And I said, I know, we've been talking about and fooling around with LEDs here. I need a kind of on indicator so I don't forget and leave this thing on all day. So I worked up a little LED circuit, quite pleasing to Billy. Billy really likes the LEDs. So I got a big red LED on there. It looks very impressive. When you turn this thing on, that red light comes on. It looks like a serious radio transmitter. It looks like a real rig. So I'm quite pleased with the LED on the front. And it's another one of these little kind of end of project refinements that seem to yield a lot of satisfaction. Now I'm looking at what else I can do. You know, and one of the things I need to do with all these DSB rigs is some speech processing. I get the feeling that I could do a lot better if I was doing some kind of speech filtering and perhaps some equalization, just to for the same reason that people do this on single sideband. I think it may even be more important on double sideband, just because if you don't, you're really broad and you might be wasting a lot of output energy in parts of the voice spectrum that aren't really that important for communication. So I've been looking at articles about speech processors and equalizations. Even a simple low-pass filter built for about 3 kilohertz, I think, would be fine. That would help just to cut out the highs. But I'm going to be taking a look at some of the speech processing circuits there. I found a bit of DSB inspiration. I wanted to mention this. You know, Tony Fishpool sent me the wonderful spread on CD issues 1 to 132 from the GQRP Club. If you guys don't have this, get it. I'm telling you, this is a real gold mine of information for solder smoke generators. And you could just search for anything. I just searched for transmitter DSB articles or transmitter articles, and I looked through until I found DSB. And this brought me back to an article from winter 1995-1996 by Papa Alpha 3 Bravo Hotel Kilo. And he's got Robert van der Zaal from the Netherlands has a really nice article in there about his 80-meter DSB CW transceiver and the story of the rig and how he built it. And it's similar to mine. He's got a complete transceiver in there, and he's got all kinds of great ideas. And he does have an AF low-pass filter with a cutoff frequency of about 2.2 kilohertz. And so that provided me some inspiration. I'm going to take a look at that, and I thank Robert for that article and for the guys at Spratt who brought it to all of us. Thanks. One other thing I've noticed in this rig, and I haven't really seen this discussed in other places, but, you know, when you build one of these, I guess anytime you build a phone rig, you know that usually you're going to have the driver stage is going to be running Class A, but the final is going to be running Class AB. So when you start thinking about heat sinks, sometimes I find that the driver is getting hotter than the final. So you might even need a more robust heat sink on the driver than you put on the final. And I've had to work with that a little bit. But anyway, double sideband has been a lot of fun. I really recommend it. I'm aware of the shortcomings, but I think it's got some advantages, and I've been having a lot of fun with it. So if you're thinking about building a phone rig, I really recommend it. There's a lot of great designs out there, some of them really simple. The Wee Willie comes to mind. There's a rig out of New Zealand that's been featured in Spratt that's really, really very simple, nice design. So, double sideband. Give it some thought. All right, switching gears a bit now. Into the really QRPP area. I'd like to talk a little bit about some developments in the world of slow speed, QRSS, real slow speed, real low power stuff. I've been working a little bit on my beacon rig. I have my beacon box in which I have my K1 EL Keir. I have the 30-meter QRSS transmitter, and I have a standard 10-meter CW beacon transmitter, all in the same box, so I can switch things around. If I want to go to 10 meters, I just throw a switch, tune up the antenna for 10 meters, hit one of the buttons, and off I go. I'm on 10-meter beacon mode, and then I can go back to our beloved 30-meter QRSS frequencies very easily also. Working on that a little bit. Got that all squared away, mostly. A lot of the Knights of the QRSS, this is the mailing list group. You'll hear us refer to the Knights. I think it's a great name for the group, the Knights of the QRSS. A lot of the Knights have, the European Knights anyway, have recently temporarily shifted to other bands. They've been on 40 and 80 meters and having a lot of fun there. Been very interesting. I hope they all come back to 30 because that's the only band that I can transmit on. So come on back to 30 meters, guys. Don't forget where your QRSS home roots are. They're definitely on 30 meters. Come back to 10.140 around there. Let's see. Alan VK2ZAY, somebody who's frequently mentioned on this program, has been crossing Australia with 470 microwatts going to VK6 DI out there. I think he's in Perth. That's been real interesting, and they've been posting things on the Knights group about those adventures. So very interesting to read about that. For those of you who want to get a sense of what you can do with QRSS, just take a look. Stan down there in Malta, 9H1 LO, 9 Hotel 1, Lima Oscar, Stan has a really great website. And not long ago, he put up an unusual kind of grabber. You know, we have regular old grabbers where somebody just takes the output of their receiver and makes it available, makes it viewable online. It's a really great service. I don't really even have a receive system for QRSS here. I just make use of the grabbers. There's one in Belgium that I use. There's another one in Denmark. Another one in Northern Italy. Stan has gone a step further, and he has made what is in essence a grabber time machine. The other grabbers are all pretty much real time, or with a 5 minute delay or a 1 minute delay, so you can see what your signal looks like now. And as I've mentioned, I sometimes make use of this by checking on my BlackBerry as I'm going through London. As I'm going through Rome on the 63 bus, I could pull out my BlackBerry and see how my QRSS signal is making it into Belgium this morning. It's great fun. But sometimes you say to yourself, "Hey, I wonder how my QRSS signal was making it into Denmark at 3 o'clock this afternoon." Well, Stan, our friend in Malta, has provided us with a way of doing that, because with his website, you can go back and search and look at the these different grabbers at different times in the past. And I'm going to give you the dates and times here, so you can take a look at not only my beautiful and fascinating QRSS upside-down FSK signal, but you can also just see how quickly 30 meters has been dropping out as old soul slips under the horizon here in the afternoon. Go to Stan's page, just do a Google search for 9 Hotel 1 Lima Oscar 9H1LO. You'll find it. Click on you'll see up in the upper left, I think he has Grabber Engine or something like that. Click on that. You have to select which grabber you want to look at. Select PA1 SDB, Papa Alpha 1, Sierra Delta Bravo. Set the date to 13 December 2008 and set the time from 1500 to 1600 UTC. Then a bunch of you'll get a display showing a bunch of different readouts for that particular hour. You'll see my signal there. You'll see it quite strong at the beginning of the hour, and then whoop, it's gone. I thought that's quite good, and that's been my experience here. Nothing's happening pretty much at nighttime. Here, my signal's not showing up on any of the grabbers when the sun's down. But as soon as the sun comes up, my signal starts making it into grabbers up there in more northern European areas. And when the sun goes down, it disappears. The signal you'll be looking at is my 50 milliwatt signal, just going to kind of a random antenna up on the roof here in beautiful downtown Trastevere. All right. That takes us through our MEPT news. I just got some sort of theory odds and ends here, some theory stuff. Thanks for everybody who wrote back and helped me out in my effort to understand beta independence and why feedback helps with this. Some guys everybody sent back really helpful info. And I'm going to post some of it up on the blog page because it was very illuminating for me. It was one of those points of theory where I kept looking at it, and I didn't quite get it. I didn't, you know, I could see the formulas. Yeah, okay, I knew the formulas proved it, but I didn't really kind of have that kind of in the gut, intuitive understanding of the whole thing that I was looking for. And emails that came in really helped with that. So now I do understand beta independence, but now here's another question. Whenever they discuss feedback, and this is usually in the context of tube-type amplifiers, they'll say that by introducing feedback, you eliminate distortion. And I'm wondering, why? Why is it that an amplifier with negative feedback would have less distortion than an amplifier without feedback? Is it that they're just saying that feedback allows you to make sure that amplifier is operating on a linear or more linear portion of the curve than it might be if it didn't have feedback? Or is there something inherent about the feedback that reduces distortion? I wasn't quite clear on that. So if any of you guys can help out, I guess that's the technical question of the week. Also in the technical area, Joe W3JDR has been doing some very nice and I think necessary work in coming up with a SPICE model for the NE602 chip that so many of us depend on in so many different rigs. Joe's been working on that. I'll get with him, and he's got some of the info's on his website already. So just do a search for W3JDR. Came across something in the ARRL electronic data book. It's kind of one of the more unusual ARRL publications. It's kind of a grab bag. I enjoy it. It's got all kinds of info in there about weird components, and then there's all sorts of kind of hints and kinks in the back, and there's interesting tables. It's really a kind of a, I don't know if you know what I mean, but it's kind of an odd publication, but there's some great stuff in there. And I was looking in there, I think I was looking for tables for resistive pads, and they were talking about how, you know, with a lot of these pads, you need very precise resistor values. And they advise that if you have a resistor that's not quite exactly the value that you want, you can just get out a file and grind it down a little bit to get it to exactly the value you want. Now, I'm not sure whether they're talking about whether these are carbon composition resistors or film resistors or what. I don't remember. But I thought that was really neat, the idea of actually modifying the value of the resistors that you're working with by taking out a file and grinding them down a bit. That's really solder smoke kind of knack, kind of ham ingenuity, kind of almost homebrewing your own resistors there. So I thought that was really good. Speaking of resistors, another great video from the guys at the Make blog. They came up with a video on the Humble resistor, and they give they put it in its historical context. They discuss Volta and Ohm and all that kind of stuff and the history of it. They actually have you make a resistor and measure the values by taking a lead pencil and putting a black mark on a piece of paper. All very interesting stuff. I have it up on the blog page. Check it out. I think you'll like it. On theory stuff, you know, every dark cloud has a silver lining. The silver lining in the technical failure of my ancient frequency counter is that it's causing me to learn more or learn. Because I don't know anything about this stuff. It's been so long since I looked at it. To learn about logic circuits, AND gates, NOR gates, counters, JK flip-flops, all that. You know, I've been resisting this. You know, I've been just telling everybody that I'm an analog guy and that's it, and I'm not going to get into the digital stuff. Guys, I feel myself slipping into the digital world, and it's this broken frequency counter that's doing it. Also, you know, the guys from the from the SDR radio group. They sent me that kit. It's sitting there. It's looking at me. It seems to, every time I walk into the shack, it seems to yell out, "You old-fashioned analog guy, you don't want to move into the modern world and all that." It's almost as if I'm one of these old guys from the 1920s sitting around saying, you know, spark forever, enough of this CW newfangled stuff. Anyway, the broken frequency counter is pulling me into the digital logic world, and I'm starting to get into it. So we may see some more digital developments here from Italy Zero Stroke November 2 Charlie Quebec Radio. A few odds and ends. Our friend Roger Hayward was over in Tokyo, and he went to Akihabara. And he came up with some really interesting observations. I really like the message that Roger sent out. I always enjoy his email. But he made a nice point. When he was over there, he noted that, and I'm paraphrasing here, but he noted that it was really kind of nice and encouraging to run into to people from another country who, you know, share our interests, who are interested in the same thing. And I guess, to paraphrase, I guess you could just say that that solder smoke respects no borders. For me, that's always been one of the great parts of having this hobby in the kind of life that we live as people who have to live overseas all the time. You run into people, and I've run into them in many, many different countries, and when you find out that you're dealing with a fellow knack victim, a fellow victim of the Dilbert disease, a fellow homebrewing radio amateur, instantly you have this connection, and you realize that that for some reason in this very, very foreign environment, in a completely different language, in a completely different culture, there's a certain percentage of us who at around the age of 13 or 14 will get intensely interested in 6L6 amplifiers or, you know, balanced modulators or, you know, class AB amps and all this stuff. And, I think it's one of the nicest parts of the hobby. And that's been one of the most gratifying parts of solder smoke. If you look at that cluster map, there's red dots all over the world, and it's been great fun to get email feedback from all over the world on this fascinating subject that keeps us together. Hey, speaking of Haywards, Wes has updated his website, put some really interesting new information up there. Do a search W7ZOI, and that'll get you to his site. While I was there, I read his article about local oscillators and the importance of keeping the output clean. That helped me with my double sideband struggles. Saw an email saying that Kanga USA is back in business after the flood. Good luck to Bill, and check out his website. Seems to have some really great offers there. I'm glad to hear that they're back in business. You know, I wanted to mention this. As I was looking through the Sprat on CD, CD that Tony Fishpool sent me, I was just sort of browsing around in there among all the 132 Sprats, issues 1 to 132, and I found out there's not 132. There's 131. I'm not complaining, but it's really interesting. The one that's missing, guys, there is no Sprat 13. If you go to Sprat 13 on the CD, there's an apology set there saying there is no Sprat 13. And I want to make clear, this is not any kind of superstition among the GQRP guys. These guys are far too scientific to be, swayed by superstitions about the number 13. Or that's what they claim anyway. There's no Sprat 13. Apparently it was just a numbering error. So I just thought that was kind of fun. Hey, thanks for everybody who's helped out with Billy's blog. He's got a lot of visitors and comments, and he's having fun with it. His next project, I think we're going to produce a video on what it's like to be an American kid in Rome. My employer sponsors a contest And the kids who are going along with us in this business are asked to produce videos on on the cities that they live in, the houses they live in, the parks they play in, the schools they go to. And that's going to be, I think, one of Billy's projects coming up. Oh, one other thing. This is sort of late news, but this is so good. You guys got to check this out. Michael, Alpha Alpha 1 TJ, the hero of the Hobbit Hole, the poet laureate of QRP and Homebrew Radio, has really come through with, we can call it a breakthrough in many different ways. This is really amazing, and I'm surprised this isn't getting more attention. This is so amazing that it had me wondering if this might be kind of a really early April Fool's thing, but it's not. This is for real. I got it on the Blogspot page. You got to check it out. Michael has taken one of these, you know, one of these compact fluorescent bulbs, you know, the bulbs that were being asked to use as replacement for the old incandescent bulbs. I did it here in the shack just because the light bulbs in the shack, and the shack is so small here, the light bulbs were producing a lot of heat, and they're actually heating up the room here. So I went ahead and bought some of these compact fluorescent lamps. They work fine. They're great. Actually, I prefer them to the incandescent now. A lot cooler. Michael discovered that there's quite a bit of useful electronic devices inside, I guess, the base of these bulbs. And he has cracked one open carefully. Be careful because there's some mercury in there. But he cracked it open, pulled out the electronic guts, and produced an 80-meter CW transmitter made almost entirely of components obtained from the compact fluorescent bulb. Oh man, this is too good. This conjures up memories of taking a little microphone elements out of telephone booth phones. Not that I ever did it myself. I heard the other people did this, but obtaining components this way and then building a rig. I'm gobsmacked that this hasn't gotten more attention. Anyway, I've done my bit. I'm now mentioning it on Solder Smoke. It's up on the Solder Smoke Blogspot page. Check it out. It's an amazing piece of work, and thanks, Michael, for bringing that to us. I suspect that we'll see a wave of compact fluorescent bulbs, rigs out there. Gentlemen, this does not mean that you should go back to the old incandescent bulbs. When you crack that one open, replace it with another compact fluorescent bulb. All right, let's see what we got. All right, I think holy cow, wait, it's time for
Solder Smoke Mailbag.
I love them.
Indeed. Yeah, Solder Smoke Mailbag. A lot of mail's built up over the last couple weeks. Lyndon has the knack. He reports that he has it. He enjoys listening to Solder Smoke, and perhaps alluding to our recent discussions of solder scents and solder smells, Lyndon claims that as he listens to Solder Smoke, he can almost smell the solder smoke. That would be an interesting software feature. We don't have that yet. Lyndon, thanks for your comments, and I'm glad that I'm glad the program does kind of at least evoke the feeling of the workbench there when you listen. Mark, KI7N, listened to Solder Smoke 96 from distant Singapore. He went there to the, I guess, the Singapore equivalent of Ikebara, and that's he tells us that's the Sim Lim Tower. And he found a variety of electronic stores and shops. It really made me jealous when I saw the pictures that he sent. And I really was pleased to find that he reported that he found one bookstore there where EMRFD, Experimental Methods in RF Design, was on sale in Singapore. Fine business. So thanks for that report, Mark. Jason... NT7S was one of the people who provided some feedback on my feedback questions. Thanks for that. Bob, KD4EBM, was another who gave feedback on the feedback. Bob gave me a real good description, the first time around, of why feedback circuits are so helpful, and why they do what they do. Then he went and I told him that I wanted to use his description. He was telling me why they help with the beta independence problem, and he gave me a really great description. But then he said no, he wanted to provide, you know, clearer descriptions that were coming from some of the electronic books he had. He gave me the descriptions from the electronic books, but I found his original description far better. So I'm going to ask for Bob's permission to post his original email or a version of it up on the Blogspot page. But he recommends two fine books, Electronic Devices by Floyd and Electronic Principles by Malvino. Thanks for that, Bob. Mike, KC7IT, in very much in the holiday spirit, used his oscilloscope to fix the Christmas light bulb string for the Christmas tree. Fine business, Mike. That's always very good. You know, when you let the family members know that this is another example of how important it is to have a good high quality oscilloscope in the house, because you never know. At least once a year, you might need to fix the light bulb strings for the Christmas tree. Thanks very much. Frank VK2AKG sent a nice YouTube video on a concert, musical concert, in which the instruments were all solenoids. I guess he was inspired to this by the Sutter Smoke music from Mark Moj Johnson. Anyway, the solenoid concert was pretty good. If you want to check it out, just go to YouTube and just type in solenoid concert. I'm sure there's only one. In addition to his work on the compact fluorescent bulb 80 meter transmitter, Mike AA1TJ has been working on return loss bridges. This is an area that I really need to, one of the many areas that I really need to learn more about and read up on. So thanks for sending that word along, Michael. And I'm going to take a look at some of the documents and articles you sent along with your message. John K7JM notes that solder smoke has crossed the DXCC barrier. Thank you very much. I'll pause for a second for applause. Let me explain. The cluster map page that we have on the Solder Smoke blog, if you look off to the right, you'll see a little world map. If you click on it, you get more information. All the red dots that show where all of the readers of the blog are. He notes that there's now a country listing. You could see the how many listeners from each country. It's displayed sort of in the lower right of the page. And he says that the Solder Smoke blog has been read in 115 countries. So very fine on that. The only problem now is I got to get the QSL cards. It'd be kind of rough. But DXCC for the Solder Smoke blog. Thanks for pointing that out, John. Jerry, NR5A, our man in South Dakota, wrote in and says that he was the one who set up the Solder Smoke SETI group, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, and they've got 8 members. They're actually crunching a large amount of data, and wouldn't it be ironic if we, the humble analog QRP homebrew, simple circuitry guys, were the ones that made the big discovery. So, Jerry, keep the group there working. Keep crunching that data, and let us know if we're the ones who make the biggest discovery in the history of mankind. That'd be great. Yeah, I would mention that on the show. Jerry recently had a birthday. Happy birthday, Jerry, and Hope you're feeling better. It sounds like you got a lot of good projects going there, and thanks for the email. Ron, WB3, AAL, recently completed his QSO number 1000 from the Appalachian Trail. Congratulations, Ron, on that. I always enjoy your messages from the trail operations. And, you know, I wanted to mention this. I guess this is the Solder Smoke Book of the Week. It's not really... Its connections to QRP and Homebrew are very tenuous. Their only connection is through the Appalachian Trail. But Bill Bryson, one of my favorite travel writers, has a book out there called A Walk in the Woods. And those of you guys who are interested in the Appalachian Trail will really get a kick out of this book. It's really funny. It talks about the trail. It talks about Bryson's efforts to walk the trail. I met Bill Bryson in London. He's a wonderful guy, a real gentleman, great author. Wrote a wonderful science book, too. It's a brief history of just about everything. It's a wonderful book. He's not a scientist. He wrote this book about all of science. Ladies and gentlemen, we're now joined by the beautiful and talented Maria Patricia.
Hi.
There she is. Anyway, Bryson wrote this book about science, and he took on all of science, all of it, in one book, and he's a complete layman. He has no degrees in science. One of the British scientists, when asked to comment about Bryson's book, said that he found it, quote, annoyingly free of errors. Anyway, go get Bryson's book on the Appalachian Trail. And congratulations to Ron for QSO number 1000. Alan, N8WQ, our man in Ohio, writes about an article that he came across about a tree-powered antenna. Again, this is another one of those articles that had me checking the calendar for to see if we were near the 1st of April, but apparently it's for real. Some guy has discovered how to get a couple of volts of electricity out of a tree. Now, I remember as a kid there was a QST article about loading up a tree and using a tree as an antenna. For some reason, that really appealed to my 13-year-old ham radio sentiments, or inclinations. Anyway, I tried that. I mean, I think I actually made a couple of QSOs with the tree. I think the QSOs were probably with the coax going to the tree. But anyway, Alan, okay, so we get the power from the tree. The tree will be the antenna. We pretty soon will have an all tree rig. And power, perhaps with some components from the compact fluorescent light bulb. This is green. See, this is Solder Smoke going green. This is it. Guys, we're on the cutting edge here. Jeremy, N1JER, has launched an effort to through the QRPL group for a group build of QRSS rigs. Fine business on that, Jeremy. Guys, that brings us to the close of this Christmas edition of Solder Smoke. Wish everybody a happy holiday season, whatever you're celebrating this year. Merry Christmas. Hope Santa Claus is good to you. Here in Italy, we get Santa Claus arrives, and he's known as Babbo Natale, or Daddy Christmas. And then a week or so later, at Epiphany time, I'm told that there's another round of gifts that arrive for the children. Maria's here with me right now. She's looking forward to both rounds of gift receiving. The second round is led by La Befana, the witch. There's in Italy, children get gifts from a witch, which is quite different. Witch is, I think, the traditional giver of gifts to children here. But lately, she's been getting some competition from Babbo Natale. So anyway, the Italian kids now get two rounds of gift giving, and our kids here are, in this regard, certainly honorary Italians. So they'll be getting a visit from Babbo Natale and from, a week or so later, from La Befana. Anyway, that's the that's the story here. We're not traveling. We're going to stay here. So I guess we may have another Solder Smoke out shortly after the new year. Wish everybody a really great holiday season. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year, and we'll We'll talk to you all again in 2009. Keep those emails coming in. We really like to receive them. Merry Christmas, everybody, and 7-3 from Rome.